Hello and welcome to this episode of PaleoCast. I'm Laura Soule.
And I'm Dave Marshall, and you are joining us in my car as we are off driving on a little field trip.
To almost Wales.
To almost Wales, to the Welsh borderlands. We're going to near Ludlow, which you should know from, if you know the stratigraphic time chart, in the Silurian. Ludlow is a group in that. And yeah, that's where we're going. We're going looking for some Silurian fossils.
What are we going to dig up, Dave?
I don't know. Probably nothing. Which is how it goes.
No, but we're going to find a Limuloides.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm looking for a fossil called Limuloides. But that's really not important right now. I love it. Google it. It's the prettiest fossil ever, I think. But anyway, we need to talk about why we're going. Field tripping is probably the best thing in paleontology for me. I absolutely love going. And this is Laura's very first paleontological dig.
Yeah, it's not my first field trip, I'd like to say. I have been on lots of field trips. I am a proper geologist. But because I usually use fossil data to do macro stuff, I don't go dig things up. So I'm going on a special digging things up trip. Yay!
And you're probably not going to find anything.
Yeah, probably not.
So if you really want to be finding some of the best fossils in the world, you're probably not going to find them just round the corner from your house. You've got to have a Lagerstätte, really, which can be a site of special preservation or a site of concentrated fossil remains, a conservat Lagerstätte. And a preservation Lagerstätte that John Patterson is going to be talking about today is the Emu Bay Shale, which is from the Middle Cambrian, I think it was. Is it from the Middle Cambrian, guys?
I'm pretty sure I think it's Early Cambrian.
Thanks, Luke. Luke Parry, worm researcher, joining us on the trip.
Extraordinaire.
Worm researcher extraordinaire. Yeah, so Early Cambrian, yep. And they've got some beautiful things that have come out of there. Loads of trilobites. Anomala carotids again, if you remember Alison Daly's episode a few months back. So it's some of the stuff they get is really, really beautiful, and they get so much of it.
Well, that sounds cool, but we're definitely going to find some stuff.
Yeah, we'll fill you in at the end of the interview, tell you what we've found, but I hope you enjoy this episode. So thank you very much for joining us, John. Could you tell us about how you became a paleontologist?
Okay, well, I guess that is somewhat of a long story, but I'll give you the short version.
You're not that old.
Well, I guess I wasn't like, well, I probably was like most kids. I liked dinosaurs when I was really little. But I grew out of that phase, and I was actually more interested in wanting to become a helicopter pilot, believe it or not.
Right, okay.
But it wasn't until my dad actually gave me his old mineral and fossil collection that I started to develop an interest in geoscience in general. And I probably wanted to be a mineralogist then before a paleontologist, but he did have a few things in his fossil collection that intrigued me. So he had some trilobite specimens, and I thought, yeah, these things are kind of cool. I'd like to know a little bit more about them. So, you know, I read more about them and started collecting them. And I guess by late high school, I knew I wanted to be a paleontologist and work on trilobites. So I was kind of lucky in that I knew what I wanted to do when I left school. And I just looked for the right pathways in terms of which uni to go to, which offered paleontology at an undergraduate level. So that ended up being Macquarie University in Sydney. And I went on from there. So I did all of my undergraduate and postgraduate studies at Macquarie. I postdocked for a little while, and then I ended up with my position at the University of New England.
Still all in trilobites?
My PhD was trilobites, but since then I've branched out into working on other groups, and I guess I would say that these days I'm more of an arthropod worker in general as opposed to specifically trilobites, but I still, you know, have a passion for them.
Okay, so today we're talking about the Emu Bay Shale, which is a Cambrian Lagerstätten.
That's correct, yep.
Okay, so where is Emu Bay?
Okay, so Emu Bay is on the northeast coast of Kangaroo Island. So Kangaroo Island is situated just off mainland South Australia. So if anyone's familiar with Adelaide, it's just a quick drive south of Adelaide until you get to Cape Jarvis, and then you jump on a ferry and 45 minutes later you're on the north coast of Kangaroo Island.
Why is it called Kangaroo Island?
Well, it's full of kangaroos, basically.
And why is Emu Bay called Emu Bay?
Well, it's called Emu Bay because there are emus, but not just any old emus. They were actually dwarf emus, but they're
right.
Now extinct.
Okay.
So,
sounding like an entirely new episode.
They were, as far as I'm aware, at least, is that they inhabited the island probably in, you know, ancient times. You know, we're talking sort of megafauna period.
Right.
And when the island was colonized by, I think it was the French to begin with, and there were people interested in seals for other reasons than, you know, keeping them and putting them in zoos and so on. So they're interested in the blubber and things, I think. But because of this colonization, as with some things, you know, people take a liking to them, want to keep them as pets or do other things with them, and eventually, to cut a long story short, they became extinct. The last two dwarf emus, I think, were put on a ship to go back to Paris, and one died on the way, and another was in a zoo for a little while, and then that died as well. So there's no more dwarf emus, but that's where the name Emu Bay comes from.
And so, what's it like to work on Kangaroo Island? Is it just hot and jungly?
No, not at all. We go to Kangaroo Island twice a year, so we have two field seasons. One's usually around April or May, the other one's in September. And we pick that time of year because it's fairly pleasant in terms of the temperature, so we're talking, you know, high teens to low 20s in terms of degrees Celsius. Apparently, that's meant to be the time where there's lowest rainfall and therefore cloud cover, because the issue is with collecting the Emu Bay Shale fossils, if we have overcast conditions, it makes it very hard to see the fossils because most of them are pancaked on the shales.
Okay.
And you need the sunlight to get the low angled light on the rock surfaces to really be able to see anything.
Right, okay. So when were the fossils first discovered?
Okay, well, at Emu Bay itself, just on the western side of the bay, there is an outcrop of Emu Bay Shale, and unfortunately that particular spot doesn't preserve the soft tissues that we see at the site we're working on, but that was actually the first site of Emu Bay Shale that was discovered, and the first shelly fossils. So you still get the trilobites there and other things like hyaliths and brachiopods. And that was discovered during a mapping exercise in the early 50s. And it was only a matter of 1 or 2 years later that a gentleman by the name of Brian Daly, who was doing his PhD at University of Adelaide at the time, on Cambrian stratigraphy of South Australia, happened to be mapping to the east of Emu Bay and came across a site called Big Gully. And the story goes that he was walking along the rock platform and happened to be looking down on the bedding surfaces that were jutting out of the rock platform, and he was seeing dinner plate sized trilobites.
Wow.
So obviously that stopped him in his tracks, and he thought, well, this is worth a further look. And it wasn't long that he started finding some of the soft bodied animals as well.
Okay, so we'll get onto the fossils in a bit, but first of all, it'd be nice to kind of work out what kind of paleo environment the Emu Bay Shale represents.
Okay, this is a tricky question because even though we've done a little bit of work on the geology and the stratigraphy in the area, there's still a lot of work to be done. And I was just having lunch with Bob Gaines, actually, who's, you know, the go-to guy for Burgess Shale type environments.
All right, okay.
And we were discussing some of the peculiar parts of the Emu Bay Shale preservation and the geology. And it seems to be quite different from standard Burgess Shale type preservation. So what that's telling us is that perhaps the environment is quite different to what you would expect at, say, Burgess Shale or Chenjiang. And the geology is telling us that we're probably pretty close to the coastline back in the Cambrian, but because of a lot of tectonic activity that there's evidence for, we suspect there was perhaps a localized basin, sedimentary basin, not too far from the shoreline. And this was probably dropping quite rapidly, which allowed for perhaps deeper water conditions than you would otherwise expect in a near shore setting. And with that probably came the right sort of conditions for this exceptional preservation. So, you know, things like low oxygen conditions, fairly rapid burial. So we're probably in a fairly deep marine setting, but we are actually close to the shoreline as opposed to being way offshore.
Okay, so you said that it was a Burgess Shale type deposit. So the Burgess Shale is a Canadian Lagerstätten of middle Cambrian age.
That's correct.
And that is, I think it was a submarine cliff in which there were turbidites, is it, which is an underwater avalanche, swept all the animals and everything off the cliff and then preserved them down in a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Essentially, okay. Yeah.
But so the Emu Bay is a Burgess Shale type deposit. So does that mean that it's just got similar soft-bodied preservation?
Yes and no. Yeah, this kind of goes back to what I was saying, that the Emu Bay Shale is quite different in some ways from Burgess. Burgess Shale preservation is mostly carbonaceous compression fossils. The problem with Emu Bay Shale fossils is that they are quite weathered, and we're still not sure whether the primary preservation mode was carbonaceous compressions or whether it's some other mode, and that's something we really need to explore in more detail. What is unusual about Emu Bay Shale preservation is that we seem to see a lot more variety and abundance of what's called early diagenetic mineralization. So in other words, a lot of the soft tissues that wouldn't otherwise be preserved in the fossil record, we're seeing replicated in different minerals that are forming or replicating the tissues during the earliest stages of fossilization. So for example, we have evidence to suggest that some of the fossils were being preserved as pyrite and others are being preserved as calcium phosphate.
Okay, so you say there's a problem with weathering at Emu Bay. Is that just because the fossils are exposed on the cliff face or aerially exposed? Can't you just dig into the hillside and find some non-weathered specimens?
Well, we are trying to do that, but we don't seem to be able to get beneath the weathering profile just yet.
Right, okay.
But you're right, it doesn't help that the deposit is right on the coastline, and that's in the modern sense, not in the ancient sense. So really, if we wanted to see really fresh rock and really fresh fossils, you'd either have to create a very big hole in the ground, which the local farmer who owns land probably wouldn't be too happy about. or we could actually put a drill core through the deposit and see if we can get fresher rock that way. But obviously you're limited to, you know, the width of the core hole then. But it might be good to work out perhaps what's happening paleoenvironmentally and geochemically, which I don't think we can really do with just surface outcrop.
Okay, so we've painted a picture of a deep basin close to the shore face in which these fossils are being preserved. So which ones were actually there? You mentioned trilobites, hyaliths, was it?
Yep. Well, we have a lot of animals now. So the last count, we're over 50 species. And the vast majority of those are completely soft-bodied. The most common fossils, by far, is of a single trilobite species called Astangia. And we literally find tens to hundreds of thousands of these things. Well, given that we've been digging there now for 7 years, they're so abundant that either if that's all that's on the rock, we tend to just throw it on the spoil heap, or we've started to keep decent specimens aside, put them in cardboard boxes, and we actually give them to school kids as educational tools. So they don't go to waste. But yeah, they're there in their thousands. And the other common trilobite is Redlichia, and that's the one I mentioned before that gets up to about dinner plate size, around about 25 centimetres in length. And the other common fossils, again, mostly arthropods. So bivalved arthropods like Isoxes and Tuzoia are fairly common. And we also get some of the more exciting animals like Anomalocaris. But we've never found complete specimens of the bigger animals like Anomalocaris. We tend to just find the frontal appendages and the flaps along the sides of the body, the odd oral cone, and we were lucky enough to find the eyes of Anomalocaris as well.
Wow.
So that was a really exciting find, actually.
Well, we'll get into that later. Which groups aren't there? Is there anything missing if you compare it to, say, like the Burgess Shale or Chenjiang?
Absolutely. The most conspicuous absence is Echinodermata. So we don't see a single specimen or even a plate of an echinoderm whatsoever, which is interesting. And what's also interesting is that you tend to have this general absence of animals that could attach themselves to the substrate, or what you would call fixer sessile. So animals like brachiopods tend to be fixer sessile, and these sorts of animals are either absent or completely rare. Totally rare, I should say, in in the deposit. So that's probably telling us something about coming back to the environment. I think that's actually telling us something about seafloor conditions, in that they're probably a bit too harsh for something that needs to fix itself there and filter feed. So I guess the other interesting thing about the biota is that a lot of the animals we see preserved, at least a lot of the common ones, are either free swimming or pelagic. So it's possible that these particular seafloor conditions, which were probably fairly low in oxygen, just weren't hospitable for a lot of animals.
Could it be the case that the fossil assemblage is allochthonous, meaning that the animals that you get there didn't actually live there, but they were swept in later? Is there any evidence, say, like a high proportion of broken up specimens that would suggest that they've been transported into this environment? Or did you think that they were actually moving in?
I think there's probably a mixture of things happening. So the really abundant trilobite that I mentioned before, called Astangia, which we find in the thousands, there's taphonomic evidence to suggest that they're actually in situ. So in other words, they haven't been washed in, because we often find molting configurations lying in the mudstones. Sometimes they'll look curled up, or only a part of their body will be curled up. And others you could interpret as having just simply decayed in place, and parts of their exoskeleton have broken apart and been slightly displaced. Whereas other organisms, so a lot of the nectobenthic forms or the pelagic forms, have either been washed in or perhaps, you know, sunk down to the seafloor when they died. But there is certainly evidence that some of the animals have been swept up and deposited in fairly rapid sedimentation episodes, where for example, you often have silt layers in between the mud rocks, and you'll find certain animals like trilobites, but also these strange animals called vitulicolians, will be all contorted and sometimes ripped up within these layers. So that suggests a fairly high energy event. So I think it's a combination.
How does the Emu Bay shale assemblage compare to the Burgess Shale in Chenjiang in terms of species diversity?
Okay, well, obviously with our research being still fairly recent, so we've been working on the site for 7 years now. The fact that we've essentially tripled the biodiversity that was known before our team started working there is pretty impressive.
In just the Emu Bay or of the Cambrian?
No, just the Emu Bay Shale,
right, okay.
Sorry.
I was going to say that's pretty good going.
Yeah. No, we've tripled the biodiversity of the Emu Bay Shale biota, I should say, in terms of number of species that were known, because there were other people before us who conducted some studies on the Emu Bay Shale biota, so people like Chris Nedden and Martin Glazner and others. But in terms of comparing that to some of the more famous Cambrian Lagerstätten like Burgess Shale and Chenjiang, we've still got a long way to go to sort of compete with those guys. I believe Burgess Shale, well, it's probably well above 200 species now. I know that Chenjiang is certainly above 200 as well. But if you use those as the bar to understand the sort of diversity you can achieve within a Burgess Shale type deposit or one of these Cambrian Lagerstätten, we're only a quarter of the way there. So I guess that's encouraging because it tells us that there's a lot more to find. So as long as we can keep getting funding, we'll keep going back. And essentially every trip, we're finding at least one new taxon.
That was going to be my next question.
All right. it has started to plateau a little bit, but in the early seasons, we were finding anywhere between 2 to 4 species, new species per trip. So that was an exciting time, but new things are still popping up.
Okay, so do you think the Anomalocaris eye was the most important or your favourite find to come out of the Emu Bay Shale?
For me personally, I think so, because I actually found that specimen with the paired eyes. It was funny, the situation, because we happened to have a film documentary crew with us at the time, and they were doing their thing and wanting to film people cracking rocks open and this, that and the other. And I happened to be in one part of the quarry, just splitting rock. And, just as these things happen, I just happened to break open this particular rock. And the pair of eyes were sitting there. And at first, I didn't know exactly what it was because I hadn't got my hand lens out yet. I knew it was unusual because of the shapes. And so I quickly got out the hand lens, had a look, and that's all it required to see the lenses. The lenses are still quite large, and I knew that given the size of the eyes, so we're talking around about 2.5 centimeters in length for each one, and that they were covered in lenses, and just the general shape, because I was familiar with these sort of pear-shaped or teardrop-shaped outlines that you see in the Burgess Shale specimens and the Chenjiang specimens, that I'd effectively worked out what they were pretty much straight away. And I passed the specimen to my colleague Jim Jago very quietly, and he did the same thing. He looked at the specimen under the hand lens, and that raised his eyebrows, shall we say. And I think I gestured, with my finger to my lips as if to say, don't say anything, because, if you have media with you at the time and you make a discovery like that, one of the first things you want to do is tell them, right? But I guess I was lucky enough to realize at the time that I needed to keep it under wraps, because if you want to get something like that published in a journal like Nature, which is where it ended up, you kind of have to keep quiet. So that was really exciting when that happened.
So Anomala Caris, if you would have listened to our interview with Alison Bailey a few episodes ago, is an arthropod. And so its eye was a compound eye.
That's correct.
That's right. So did it just have more detail than any other Anomala Caris did eye?
Yes.
Right, okay.
So, obviously Anomala Caris eyes have been known for a while now, based on the beautiful articulated specimens that you see from the Burgess Shale. There's nice material from Chenjiang as well. And when you look at these specimens from either Burgess or Chenjiang, there's no doubt that, you know, you can see where the eye structures are. But the problem with specimens from those sites is that you tend to just see smooth surfaces. So you can see the outline of the eyes, but you don't see any surface detail. And that's probably due to the fact that these are carbonaceous compression fossils. So that's not allowing for the sort of detail you'd want to see in the visual surface of a compound eye, for example. In the case of the Emu Bay Shale Anomala Caris eyes, they're actually replicated in iron oxide, which was once pyrite. So because this happened at a very early stage during the fossilization process, it preserved all that detail that you don't otherwise see in other specimens from around the world. So because of the unique fossilization processes in Emu Bay, that's allowed us to get a lot more anatomical information from the eyes.
And so what were you able to work out? Could you like really get insights into what an Anomala Caris did could see?
Pretty much, yeah. So one of the first things we did, which is obvious, is to try and estimate the number of lenses in each eye, because that does tell you a little bit about resolution. And that was a slightly tricky exercise, but luckily one of the eye pairs was fairly complete, so it was just a matter of measuring the surface area of that eye, estimating roughly how many lenses were in a certain patch that was well preserved, and then just extrapolating that. So in doing that, and even though it was probably a more conservative estimate, there were well over 16,000 lenses in each eye. Now, anyone that knows anything about compound eyes in arthropods knows that that's a pretty impressive number. There's only a few other arthropods that really surpass that sort of number. You know, you're talking things like dragonflies, which can have up to 28,000. But they're highly visual predators. So the fact that Anomala Caris had eyes of that resolution, I think really helped solidify that argument that they were visual predators. Of course, there's now the fairly recent work that's suggesting that not all Anomala Caris are predators, and I tend to believe that. I think because of the diversity of Anomala Caris, there's going to be diversity of feeding modes, but I would suspect that the Anomala Caris from the Emu Bay Shale, or at least the one that had this type of eye, would have certainly been predatory.
How have your studies of the Emu Bay Shale fossils changed or contributed our understanding of arthropod evolution and family relationships?
Okay, well, I guess if we again use the example of Anomala Caris, what you could take from just looking at the eyes from an evolutionary perspective, it's helped actually map on certain significant arthropod traits that were otherwise ambiguous from previous information that we had. So people have long suspected that anomalocaridids are arthropods. The problem with anomalocaridids, though, is that in calling them an arthropod, it's almost a misnomer because they don't have jointed legs, which is what arthropod means. Now, they do have jointed frontal appendages, but you could argue that Anomalocaris isn't a true arthropod. It's sort of almost on its way to becoming a true arthropod. So the fact that we could find unequivocal evidence of compound eyes, which is largely an arthropod trait, helped nail the affinity of anomalocaridids. And it also told us about, you know, where compound eyes actually map onto the arthropod evolutionary tree. So we now know that with anomalocaridids being quite basal in the tree, it tells us that the eyes appeared fairly early on in the early evolution of arthropods.
What are some of the big questions left about the Emu Bay shale?
I guess that's what we have been discussing in terms of understanding the specifics of the paleo environment, but also what some of these taphonomic pathways are and how that actually works.
How the fossils form. So.
Essentially, yeah. So the fact that we're seeing different preservation modes in the one fossil deposit and the fact that some of these minerals that are replicating the soft tissues are replicating different tissues in different ways, the story gets quite complicated. And we really need to be able to work out what's happening paleoenvironmentally and perhaps geochemically in order to work out how those preservational pathways are working. So that's probably the biggest area to really start to focus on now.
And just in closing, you've done so much work in the early Cambrian, especially looking at trilobites from Australia. So could you sell trilobites to our audience? Why should people study early Cambrian arthropods?
Well, I think early Cambrian arthropods, or particularly trilobites, are a great group to study just because they're so abundant and so diverse. They're a great model organism to try and answer just about any big question in paleontology, or at least Cambrian paleontology. You know, obviously there are limitations with that, but there are quite a number of big questions that could be, or problems that could be tackled using this group. So and they're just cool animals. I mean, the fact that, you know, you've only got to look at something like Anomalocaris and just be in awe of it. I mean, the fact that something like that was around 500 million years ago is pretty cool.
Well, John, thanks very much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
I really enjoyed that episode. It's crazy to think that they have just so many fossils that are coming out of the Emu Bay shale that even the trilobites, there's so many of them that it just kind of gets in the way of all the other fossils.
Yeah, well, that wasn't really the case with our field trip today.
Well, yeah, so we left you at the start with our impending field trip. We're now back from that. So, Laura, what did you find?
I found a trilobite. That was really exciting.
It was. They're pretty rare from where we were digging.
And loads of graptolites.
Well, I guess that's kind of the same as Emu Bay Shale has with trilobites. We had with graptolites. There were just so many that we just had too many to collect.
Yeah, but you found a really good fossil, right?
I found my favourite fossil in the world. That's what we were there for. I found it. I am the most happy that any paleontologist could be.
So, was it Eurypterid?
No, it wasn't.
I thought
it was even better. No,
even
it's not.
Better.
I just say Eurypterids are my favourite. Everyone knows that I like Chasmotaspidids anyway, so.
Yeah.
But it was a Cynzephsurin, which is kind of like the little stem to horseshoe crabs. Found one. So happy. There's only really been two specimens found this century, I think.
Is that because?
That's because of me. That sounds so
Is that because nobody else looks for them, though?
Yeah, I think so. No one else looks for them, but I've found them. That's what I was there for. Oh, they're beautiful. And this is why field tripping is so good. I love going out in the field.
It was a really amazing fossil. You were kind of just digging through a pile of what looks like crud and then cracked open this tiny little piece and then there was just this perfect fossil inside.
Absolutely gorgeous. So everyone, get out into the field. Show us what you've got. Show us what you've found.
Yeah, show us what you've found, but it won't be as good as my one.
But it'll never be as good as my fossil or Emu Bay.
Anyone who's going fossil hunting in America for dinosaurs, let us know. Their fossils will be better than yours.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Or China.
Speaking of dinosaurs, Paleocast is going to be at SVP, the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology meeting this year in Berlin.
There will be things other than dinosaurs. Lots of different vertebrates, all the different types, but some dinosaurs.
Probably mainly dinosaurs.
A lot of dinosaurs.
But we do love dinosaurs. And if you have not yet listened to last year's coverage from LA, please check that one out.
So that'll be the next time you'll hear from us. And that's it for this episode.
See you later.
Bye.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.